This is an interview with Frances Snyder on October 24th, 2007. We're in Studio X, Campbell Hall, Urbana, Illinois. Interviewer is Nancy Rotzel. The videographer is Henry Radcliffe. Okay. Frances, tell me about where were you born?
I was born in Rankin, Illinois.
And you were there when World War II started?
No, I had, by that time I was working in Chicago. It was really hard to get a job during that period because I graduated from high school in 1935. And it was at the end of the Depression. It was very difficult to get a job. And at that time, people, especially people who were not affluent, had no idea about loans for school or that sort of thing. So I was a girl, too. And who educated girls? Only people who had money. And my dad was a railroad worker, so we were comfortable. And he always had a job. But I went to Chicago to work. I had a cousin who worked at Spiegel's. In fact, she was a corporation secretary, and she made arrangements for me to be hired. So I went to work at Spiegel's, the mail order house.
So that's where you were when World War II started?
I was working there, yes. Yes. And I also, I liked Chicago. It was a great place to be young and single in. Mm-hmm. And I went to the Chicago Arena to skate a lot of times. It was something I really enjoyed. It was a wonderful exercise because I sat a lot at work. And on the Sunday morning of Pearl Harbor, I had gone to Mass very early, and then I went down to the arena to skate. And we were interrupted about 10:30 with an announcement that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. It was such a shock because we knew that the Japanese had just been in Washington, and we thought they had sort of resolved their differences. So it was very much of a shock. And I had two brothers that were already in the service. One of them was in Panama. He was my youngest brother, and he had been in the Air Force for almost a year. He joined right after he graduated from high school because he knew he couldn't get a job in Rankin. And he was sort of desperate, and he thought, well, why not? He'd get a trade or learn something. And he was sent to mechanic school in Chanute. And that had just begun to blossom. It had been an air base during World War I. But there were always men there. But in 1940 and 41, they began to really train men. That was one of the biggest problems with the United States was that they didn't have a standing army of any size. And so it was imperative to get these men in. And my oldest brother worked in Chicago, and he worked for a commercial artist studio. And he was sent to, he was drafted. And he went to Trenton, New Jersey, to the base there. And they discovered he could play the bugle. They needed buglers. So he ended up playing the bugle. And because he did that, they sent him to a new base in Camp Crowder, Missouri. No, it was Neosho, Missouri. And he was sent to Camp Crowder for a band. They were forming a band there. So he played the alto horn in the band. And because he had some very good office skills, he became the radar, the company clerk. And he sat out the whole war there. He didn't sit it out, but he was there during the whole war. They had to go on bivouac and be trained as soldiers, but he never had to leave Camp Crowder. He was one of the lucky ones. And then my other brother was drafted right after the 1st of January, and he was sent to Wyoming. He was in ordnance, and he went overseas in July of 41. And she's my sister-in-law now, but my brother had met this gal at a dance, and he told me to call her. She was a very nice person, so I called her. So they corresponded. And he wanted her to come to New York or to New Jersey, where he was stationed at Fort Dix, because he knew he was going overseas. And so her parents would not allow her to go by herself. This girl was 22, but she still paid attention to her parents. And so she called me and she said, "Will you go with me?" Well, I didn't have the money, but my mother and dad paid for my way so that I could go with her, because I know they thought he might not come back.
How did you keep track of them, where they were?
Well, we knew that he was going to the European theater.
Right.
And he was sent to England. Well, we went to Trent, or no, it was Fort Dix, to visit him. And we were there over the 4th of July weekend. And most of the men were supposed to be confined to their base. But because there were so many thousands of them waiting there to go over in a convoy, that the officers turned their head when they went into New York for the weekend. Well, they knew these boys might never come back. And so we visited him for the weekend, and the next week he was sent out. Of course, we didn't hear from him. Or I think he went out the 17th of July. Well, the strange part of it was I found out much, much later that my husband was there at the same time waiting to be transported to England.
So you didn't know your husband at that time?
Oh, no, I didn't know him at all. And he was working at Dayton at Wright-Patterson Field. He was an aircraft electrician, and he worked for the civil service. But he decided that if there was a war, he felt it was his duty to go. So he joined the Air Force, and they sent him over to England as an aircraft electrician. And he was in England for in several different places, in Manchester and Ipswich, but he repaired the electrical systems on the B-17s.
And you have a connection to B-17s, right?
Right. Well, anyway, he was there for 2 years. And they were asking for volunteers for pilot school, so he put his name in. And they sent him back to the U.S. to go to pilot's training. Well, they did a lot of tests, and by that time, when he came back, it was the end of 43. He had been over there for 2 years. And so he was... They were washing a lot of men out. They had all these men coming back, but you know, the Army was never known for its efficiency. And so he was eliminated because of his something different about his depth perception. So they didn't know what to do with him. They didn't send him back over to be an aircraft electrician, which he was trained to do. They sent him to radio school. Okay, and he went to Madison, Wisconsin, to the Army Airways Communication School, which was the ground school. And anyone who was involved in the ground school had to have a very high speed in order to take any kind of communications that came across. So those men were required to be able to type and to take 16 words a minute on the typewriter. And meanwhile, I had been working at Spiegel's, by that time I had been promoted to be a department manager, and we did answered complaints, customers' complaints about their accounts, and Spiegel sold for a long time. They sold merchandise on credit. People would pay a dollar a month for it, but that's how they got started, and they didn't charge anything. Well, I don't know whether it was the Federal Reserve Board, who was that decided that you could not sell merchandise on credit without interest. And that was because Sears was very influential in Montgomery Ward. And this little old upstart company was moving along, and we're going to be a big challenge to them. So then we had to charge interest. Well, they still managed to have a lot of customers. But anyway, they had complaints about being charged too much or too less. Right. And this is the department where I worked. And they decided that they needed to do a better job of answering customers' letters, so they would hire some college girls to write the letters. So they had hired a few, and a lot of them were qualified to be teachers, but they couldn't get employment. So these four or five girls came to work for me in this department. I became acquainted with them, and one of the gals was very, very bright, and she had graduated magna cum laude from Clark College in Dubuque, Iowa. And a nun friend of hers wrote to her, and the nun was at St. Louis University. And she said, "Well, Yvonne, why don't you go? I have inquired and go and apply to this captain for a teaching job down here, because these people are coming to St. Louis University to be trained, and then they teach the soldiers in the field of radio." So Yvonne called and made an appointment for herself, and she talked me into doing it too. Well, I didn't think I had a chance because I didn't have a college degree. But I went in and applied. I talked to the captain. He said, "Oh, yes, you come take the test." Well, the funny part was, after I took the test, I found out I got the highest grade on the code check as for anybody. And this...
What was the code check?
Well, that was we had to listen on headphones. We had it was an aptitude check is what it was, to see if we would have an aptitude to take code. And it had to do with short and long sounds.
Morse code,
yes. And I had a background in music, so it wasn't, that helped a lot. So I went to St. Louis University for 3 months to take the course. And then they sent us out. I had planned to go back to Chicago to the Coliseum, where they had the code school, mm-hmm. And they closed it. They were getting enough. This was in 42, that they were getting enough operators, and so they were kind of stopping sending so many to the different areas. Well, they closed the school in Chicago first. The men were billeted the Stevens Hotel there. And so then we had to choose a different place to go. All the people who had been trained for Chicago had to choose a different place. So I picked Scottsdale because it was in Illinois, and I didn't want to be too far from my parents. I was the only kid they had left in this United States. So anyway, I went there to school and or to teach. And we had men, many of them were only 18 or 19 years old, and they came there first to take Morse code. And we worked worked different shifts. There were three shifts and one. And the day shifts were all right, but the night shift was terrible because all the instructors did was wake the men up because the code was monotonous. And they would hear it over their headphones and doze off. And it was difficult for the instructors to have to work that night shift. It was just a waste of money.
What were the men, once they went through the training, what were they going to do?
Well, they were going to be gunners on B-17s.
So a gunner needed to know Morse code?
Well, see, they had two jobs. They were the radio operator, but they were also the waste gunners, because that's where the radios were situated. They had to take Morse code, but they also had a division. They took half a day of the code, and they had half a day of mechanics, because they were required to repair the radios if anything went wrong, so they had to know. And radios were different then. They had a lot of components to them. And in order to get a circuit, they had to change frequencies depending where they were. And they had three controls to change the frequencies. It was a whole different kind of radio than people know now. And they would have to contact the ground stations as well as other planes.
And so you were able to also teach them the mechanics in addition?
Actually, we took mechanics at the code operators took mechanics at St. Louis U. But no, we were not required. We just had to know a little bit about it and realize and be able to speak with them about it. No, if we were teaching Morse code, we were 4 hours with each class teaching Morse code. And it became pretty monotonous. For a long time, I worked in the classrooms doing it, but then I also worked in what we call the transmitting room. And I would send code checks at certain, you had to be able to time it for the speed that you were sending. And I would send code checks or practice things a lot of times, because all the code came into the rooms on machines. And when they first started to learn, that's what they learned was from the machines. But that was not like everybody's, what they called FIST, was different. And they had to be able to, and in fact, you could almost distinguish who was sending the code if you knew the people by how it came over. That sounds strange, but it's true. And anyway, the students had to pass 10 words a minute in order to be an operator on the airplane.
So that's what your husband was doing too?
No, he was in a different division. He was sent to the ground school. Now the ones who
was
were,
he teaching or was he?
No,
being
he was
trained?
He was in school. He okay. was in training. Well, after let's see, the beginning of 44 then, they closed down the school at Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and those people were sent to Scott. And they changed the whole setup around because we have been training in two areas of Scott for the code groups for the bomber personnel. Well, then we still had the bomber personnel coming in, but we also had the ground crews. So they took the people who had the highest speeds in code to teach the ones who came in as ground crew. And they're the ones who had to do the 16 words a minute. And so I was teaching them, and I also worked in the transmitting room too.
You said it was hard sometimes for a woman to find a job. Was there discrimination and problems with women working in?
Actually, the government was a lot better then the people we had that I had the most trouble with, of all things, were not the civilian personnel. They were the non-coms at the that were running the school. Every room had a non-com. And the shift chief was a non-com, so all of the civilian personnel were subject to these non-coms. And there was one staff sergeant that now I would have had a great case for sexual harassment. I would have, because he just would not leave me alone. And I tried to get onto a different shift, but that didn't work. So I always managed to have someone in between myself and him to keep him from bothering me.
A lot of variety among the backgrounds of the people who were working?
Yes. One of the things that was interesting, we had in the AACS school, which was the school for the ground operators, a man who was had been at Boca Raton. He was a scientist. He had two or three advanced degrees in different areas of science. Mm-hmm. And he told me that he was removed from his job in Boca Raton, Florida, where they were doing the radar tests and sonar tests, where radar was finally discovered or perfected. And he was working there, and the people in the community were so adamant against the government having him there because he was black. And he was brilliant. So the government did not want to, they couldn't conscientiously let him go. They had a lot of black men in the service by then. And so they sent him up to the school in Scott. Well, this man was a marvelous, one of the best radio operators I ever encountered. He could send on the bug, which is the key that goes back and forth for rapid. They called it a bug
instead of the mouse for our computers.
Right, and he could send it so fast, and he was a very, very entertaining, interesting person. We got to be great friends. When I worked in the transmitting room with him, had a great sense of humor, and I just really did like him. And he had a girlfriend in St. Louis, and he said they were going to get married, but he wanted to be bad a little while yet. And then we had another woman who was teaching there, and she never got to teach, which was just terrible. She had come from South Dakota, and she had been working up in South Dakota. Well, they sent her down to Scott, and she was also black, and she was a bacteriologist. She had a degree, and she wanted to do something to help the war effort. So this is what she did. She was on leave from the University of Minnesota, and they put this woman in the code room checking, grading the code checks. This is how much she could contribute, they felt. It was really, I was appalled. I lived in Rankin, and we had one black family, and really most of the people treated them just like everybody else. They were the barbers, and they were my friends. I always had, our family had a great experience with them. But I realized that I heard someone say, well, they kept their place. And I thought, what do you mean their place?
You certainly had an interesting group of people. How many people do you figure that you would train?
Oh, the classes lasted about 8 weeks. It took about 8 weeks for them to go through, or maybe a little longer. And so I had students that went over and did their 25 missions on the B-17s and came back. And this is what what really, really got to me, that they were such children almost when they went over. And they came back and they were tough soldiers. You know, and some of them didn't come back. I had one young fellow who was from Champaign. His parents lived here. And he was just 18, and he was so homesick. And three other instructors and I had a house. And we would invite the students sometimes for dinner because we really felt sorry for them. They were so homesick. Of course, we had to worry about our ration stamps, too, because we didn't have any better deal on the ration stamps than anybody else did, and there were so many restrictions on what our food was, and it also depended on what you could find at the grocery store at the time. Well, Belleville had a marvelous little grocery. The people were German. There were a lot of Germans in Belleville, and they had wonderful sausages and cheeses and that sort of thing. Well, this young fellow's mother would send him ration stamps, and he'd say to me, "Miss Morrow, would you get me some food with this?" Because the food there was C rations. When I first went to, this is beside the point, but when I first went to Belleville, the instructors were allowed to eat their lunch in the mess hall, and it cost 35 cents. And so we would eat because we would get meat, which we didn't get all the time at home. And it was very good food. Well, all of a sudden they barred the personnel from eating in the mess hall, and they changed the rations. Some new, I suppose the new commander came in, and they started giving them C rations, which were pretty skimpy. And so these men really didn't get enough to eat. Part of it was training for being in the field. I know that because they wouldn't get the same things when they were overseas as they got here anyway. And so they were all hungry. And they would eat things at the mess hall, but their money, $21 a month, it didn't last very long. At the PX, it didn't last very long at the PX. So the mother sent the boy the ration stamps, and he'd ask me if I'd get him some food in town. So we would go to the grocery store and get him a lot of, and all these buddies just loved him because he'd share with them, you know. But we often had him, when it was his day off, we'd have him come and have dinner with us. Well, later on, after he had left, been gone from there long time, after I moved back to my folks' house, after I was married, one of our friends there had been in the radio. He had been a radio operator, and he was in the South Pacific, and he came by to see me because he knew what I had done. And he told me that this boy from Champaign, he mentioned that he knew him. And I said, "Well, whatever happened to John? Is he okay?" And he said, "No, he was lost over the Pacific and never found." So that really bothers a person, you know, because I was really very fond of this. And he was way younger than I was, but he was just such a sweet boy and so innocent. I guess maybe that's what bothered me. But anyway, the ACS moved down there. My husband had been sent to Madison. Well, then they closed the school at Madison. So all that personnel and the men were sent into Scott Field. And one day I had to take a class for someone else who was absent. Well, they had a big problem with flooding of the Mississippi, and they called the men from Scott out to work on the dock. On the dikes. And so for some days there, we had absolutely nobody in school. We went to work, but we didn't have anybody in school because they were working on the dikes to stop the river from coming up any higher. So anyway, this one day, I was sent to a different classroom to teach, and that's where I met my husband. He was one of the students, and I thought, well, he looks older than the rest of them, because we were getting 18-year-olds, you know. And I guess maybe the thing that impressed me most was his hands. He had huge hands, but he was so well-kept. It just looked beautiful. Anyway, after when we had our break, while he came over and started talking to me, he said, you know, I need some help. He was having a real hard time with code. So I said, okay, I'll help you. That's what we were supposed to do. So I sent him code, you know. But then after that, I went back to my own class. But he always found me during our break to have conversation, tell me how he was getting along and everything. And one of the other fellows, after about 5 or 6 weeks of this, said to him, Schneider, why don't you ask for a date? And he said, well, I will as soon as we have a day off that's the same, because we had different days off because of and we were working the night shift. So anyway, after we got on the day shift, well, he did ask me to go out to a movie. And it was going to be on his day off, which was the following week on a Wednesday night. And on Sunday, we were on the morning shift, so we went to work at 6 in the morning and worked till 2 in the afternoon. And after the shift on Sunday, I went into the PX and was sitting there waiting, because they had a special dispensation. Then they didn't have Mass at the Catholic Church during the afternoons. But they had a special dispensation because it was a military operation. So I thought, well, I'll just go out here. So I waited after I got done work at the PX to go to Mass. And Jack came in and sat down to talk to me. And he said, well, what are you doing out here? And I said, well, I'm waiting to go to church. And in a little while, he excused himself, and he said, well, I have to go back to the barracks, and I'll see you later. So he left. And when I got up to go to church, here he is coming in his Class A uniform toward me. And I said, well, where are you going? He said, I'm going to church with you. So that's the first place we ever went together.
Better than a movie.
Right. Well, then he had to... After he got out of school there, they sent him to teletype school in Chanute. He went from the radio school to teletype school. Well, he was already a sergeant, and they handled him a little differently than they did some of the other boys. He was too big to be a gunner. He couldn't be a gunner, and. I guess they had the personnel they needed for most of the stations, and they sent him so that he would be equipped to handle a better job when he got to the radio station he was supposed to be assigned to.
And what did someone do in teletype school?
They learned teletype.
Well, to do...
Well, it came over a teletype machine, and they had to be able to read it, and also... And it was encoded. All everything was encoded, and the be able to send out messages on teletype, be able to repair the equipment and all that sort of thing. So he was 6 weeks at Chanute. So because it was close, and I came up to visit my folks in Rankin on the bus, he'd get on the bus and ride up and spend the weekend at my folks' house. And my mother, first time she saw him, fell in love with him. That was important to me. But anyway, he was there for 6 weeks. And after he left down there, then sent a whole new battalion into the second area where I worked. And they were barracks after barracks of black men. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't one white man in the group. They put all the white ones over in the third area. All the white men were assigned to the third area, and all the men that were in the second area were black.
Right. Were they learning the same thing as your husband?
Yes. And I taught them and it didn't bother me. Right. I would have to say that probably they were much more respectful. I never had a problem with any of my students in the black group. I think maybe, I don't know whether they felt privileged to be there or anxious to learn or what the reason was, but we didn't have discipline problems with them.
Was this like decoding secret messages?
Yes, they would be, yeah. See, we didn't teach any of the, they changed the code every day. The cycle groups that they had to take were five different figures, but there were four letters and a number for each cycle group. Now they sent weather the same way, but the weather was sent with the numbers, and there were five numbers. The weather you could, was numbered, just numbers that came over the wire, and the cycle groups, and those were changed every day. And when they got on the airplanes or were in the stations, they were not advised of what the code would be for the day until they got the message early in the morning. So it was, of course, to keep the enemy from knowing, because anybody in the air could intercept those messages. And so when the person in the air received the message from a ship or something, he had to decode it first before they understood, before he could even tell the pilot what it was.
So weather would be to tell them what they'd be flying into,
right.
And the other would be what, giving them directions what to do? Or?
Right, right. And telling them, for instance, if there was a ship someplace or giving them an idea about their destination as bombers and that sort of thing. And, of course, they had to have the weather if they were especially going over that English Channel, which is where a lot of them went directly to, because most of the air bases at that time were in England. It wasn't until after D-Day that they had any air bases in France or any other part of Europe. Of course, there were some in Africa, too, but most of them went out from England, and they had long-range bombers. That's what the B-17s were.
Where was your husband that he was doing the...
He was in Ipswich, which was right outside of London, and he was there during the Blitz. And they had to go to bomb shelters very much at the time. And this I did not know until he passed away last year. He told one of my kids about it. He never told me about being in a supply truck and having to go to pick up supplies for his unit. And he and another fellow went in, and the fellow was driving the truck, and he said to Jack, "You go in and get, I'll stay with the truck," because they couldn't leave the truck. Somebody's stealing blind. So he went in to get whatever it was. When he came back out, the truck had been hit by a bomb, and the man was dead. But they spent a lot of time in the bomb shelters and that sort of thing.
Yeah. You said your husband had some pretty exciting secret stuff to do, though.
Well, he did. Oh, yes, I forgot about that. That was here, though. That was when after he left Chanute. They sent him out to Fort Ord, California. Now, why, I don't know. He thought he was going to be shipped to the Pacific. But because he had 2 years of overseas duty already, instead they shipped him to Wichita Falls, Texas. Well, we were engaged, and we had talked it over, and neither one of us were really, we weren't 18 years old, we were a little old. So we decided to go ahead and get married. So he made the arrangements down at Shepherd Field, and I had left my job and went home to Rankin to be with my folks a couple of weeks, and my mother was going down with me. We had everything arranged, so we went down, and we were married at Shepherd Field, Texas. Well, instead of being sent overseas, they sent him to Cincinnati, Ohio, which was his hometown. Yeah, to Lunkin Airport there. Well, he was there for about 6 or 8 weeks. And then he got new orders to go to Minneapolis. And he was assigned as station chief at Old Chamberlain Field in Minneapolis. And this is why he had to have both the code and the teletype, because he was a non-com, and they wanted a non-com to run the station. So he was assigned as station chief. Well, I went to Minneapolis for a while, but we could not find a place to live. We lived in a private home. People who had allowed soldiers to live there because they felt they needed to do something for the war effort. They were wonderful, wonderful people, and they were so nice to us. But we just had a room, and I got pregnant right away. So my mother said, "Well, you have to come back home." And there was always a place, you know, enough space for me there. So I came back to Rankin, and he was still at Old Chamberlain. And in what was in late July, 1st of August, in 40, 45, it was, yeah, that, of course, the war in Europe was over by then, because Hitler had finally surrendered. But the Japanese were still holding out. So this one night he got a message earlier in the day that no one was supposed to be at the station except him that night. And he was going to have, and it had to be top secret, he was going to have a duty to perform, and he needed to send weather reports to this squadron that was flying over Canada. And then he had to send a teletype message to a special address in Washington, D.C., of their position. And he had to do this every half hour. And he had contact with this group of planes until they were out in the almost across the Pacific Ocean. And he told me about it afterward, but he said, "I don't know what it was." And a few days later, when the bomb landed on Hiroshima, he realized that he had been sending the weather reports to the Enola Gay group that went across Canada. So it took a lot of little people to accomplish that.
Did your brothers all live through it, and your husband?
Yes, they all did. My brother, who was in France, well, he went. He was the one that was in ordnance, and he went over to France or to England about the same time Jack did, and he was there until after D-Day, and I don't know exactly what they did in all that time, but anyway, he went in. To France 10 days after D-Day. And he was with ordnance, and they were putting up communication lines for the troops as they came in. But the only thing he really told me very much about was that he was sick, because he walked. They had to walk and do their work. And he said, "Mom, you wouldn't believe the dead bodies that we had to pass. And we couldn't stop to see who they were, whether they were American or not, because they had a crew that came along and did that." But he said the stench was unbelievable. And he went into Germany after the troops, you know, and it was part of the I don't know what they called it, the ones that were there after. But he came home. Of course, they were doing that all during the summer that year, and he was sent back. He was one of the first ones that was able to come back and was discharged. And then my brother in Missouri was discharged shortly. Now, they began to discharge everybody, but my mother in Panama came back in August the year before. He had been in Panama for 4 years. And it was very, very sad because he had a terrible drinking problem. And they sent him down to Eglin Field in Florida for R&R. And he was a staff sergeant by then. And he was mustered out right after the bombing of Hiroshima. He was the first one that came home. But he never talked very much about what happened to him. And there was not anything on the Ken Burns show that showed anything about any activity in the Gulf of Mexico. But from the few things that he said, I am sure there had to have been some. And he saw a lot of things that were not ever talked about. He went down, he was 18 years old, and when he came back, he was just like an old man. It had to be a terrible experience for him. And then I had a cousin who had gone here to school at the University of Illinois, and he was in the marching band, and he was in ROTC. Well, he was called up in 1944, and they went to boot camp for a certain length of time, and then he was sent over to England. And he was one of his battalion was one of the group in the Battle of the Bulge. And he wrote his mother on the first day that he was in the battle that it was the awfulest thing. He said, "I can't believe that we have to kill these men." He said, "It's just almost more than I can bear." Well, the next day he was captured. He was captured with a whole group of men in the Battle of the Bulge. And they sent him across Germany and to a prison camp in Poland. Well, his parents didn't know where he was. He was now the 14th of December is when it happened in 44. And he was in this German prison. He was reported missing in action. And he was there for 4 or 5 months. And the prison was in Poland. And the Russians had begun to fight back. They began to fight the Germans back, and they were pushing the German troops back. And Hitler, like Napoleon, thought he could overtake Russia, and he didn't think about all the things that his troops weren't used to that they confront in Russia. But anyway, this one day they could hear the Russian guns, and the Germans were pushing these prisoners. They took them out of the prison camp and were marching them back to Germany. And this one night they stayed in a Polish farm in the barn, and Ralph said he made up his mind he was not going back to Germany and be in another prison camp. So he hid in the straw, he and another fellow. Well, a lot of the guys had the same idea, but when the Germans came in and threatened to machine gun the straw when they came out, well, they knew the two men were there, so they just sprayed it with the bullets, but they were in a hurry, so they left, and he escaped. And the Polish farmer fed them. He knew they were there, and he came out at night and brought them food. And then one morning, there was a German patrol that had stayed there in the barn at night, so they couldn't go to sleep. They were afraid they might make a noise and wake them up. And then they heard these men come up on horseback the next morning, and it was Cossacks, Russian Cossacks. And they just mercilessly shot the Germans. And then they saw the American boys, the two American boys, so they took them back to their lines. And they hitchhiked to Moscow to the American embassy. So he was gone for almost 6 months before he got back to the U.S.
When did his parents find out that he was living?
Well, after he had been missing for about 3 months, they got word and they knew that he hadn't been killed, but he was in prison. And what was interesting, they had this page in the Gazette about the prison camp, the German prison camp in Hoopston. Well, his mother and dad lived in Hoopston. He was an only child. And his mother was very active in the church there. Well, a lot of the young German men were Catholics. And so they allowed them to come to Mass on Sunday. Well, Germany, the whole of Bavaria is Catholic. And so they must have been a lot of them from that area of Germany. And they didn't want to go back to Germany. They definitely didn't want to. So they weren't going to try to escape. They were getting good food. They were a lot better off here than going back. None of them wanted to go back and fight. A few of them could speak English. So she got acquainted with a couple of them. She used to take them cookies and this sort of thing. And then to have her son end up in a German prison camp, that was very difficult for her. But he always said, well, Mom spent all her time. I was in there on her knees, so I know that sure helped me. So anyway, that was just one of the things that happened during the war.
Did your family have a big celebration when everybody came back?
Oh, yes. The first time we had been together for Christmas for so long. And my oldest brother got married after he was in Fort Dix, so my folks never got to his wedding. My youngest brother was ready to go overseas, and he was there, and he was his best man before he went to Panama, and this was before the war even started. And then after Greg got, and of course Jack and I got married, mm-hmm. and my mother did get to go to that. And then my brother Greg came back, and this girl that I had gone to New York with, and he got married. Well, she and I had been really, really good friends. After I first met her, we used to meet and have dinner together, and when I go down to Rankin to visit my folks, she'd go with me on the train, and so my parents knew her real well, and I really liked her. And so it was kind of great that they decided to get married. So my parents did get to go to their wedding, which was good. And so we were all there on Christmas. And Jack had gotten, he was the last one to be discharged from Minneapolis. And he and two other fellas decided that they were going to, they got money for their railroad fare. They had to go all the way from Minneapolis to Portland, Oregon to be discharged. And it was a really, really cold winter. We had a lot of snow and ice, and it was bitterly cold. But they decided that they'd pool their money and buy this old junk heap of a car. And then when they got out, this one fellow wanted the car, so he said, I'll just buy the car from you. And we'll save some money by driving instead of going on the train. Well, they got out in Idaho at the Coeur d'Alene Pass, and were just to pass that, and they ran out of gas. And it was 20 below zero. And they were stuck out in the middle of almost nowhere. Well, they had passed a farm house about 3 miles back. So they drew straws on who was going to stay in the car. A couple of them were going to stay in the car, and the other two were going to walk back to the farmhouse to get some gas. And Jack stayed in the car. Well, he and the other fellow were just dozing off, which was a very bad thing to do when it was that cold. And this big gas truck pulled up alongside him. Are you having trouble, fellas? And he saw they were soldiers, and they said, well, we're out of gas. And he said, well, you know, my gas tanks are locked, but we may be able to get some gas out of the hose. So they got enough gas out of the hose to start the car and get it to go back to the farmhouse. So the woman at the farmhouse had been her husband was laid up with the back problem, so she was trying to take care of her animals and everything. So the boys helped her with the animals, and she fixed them breakfast. Yeah. And then they bought gas and got to Portland. Well, then I didn't hear from him all that time that he was going, and I didn't know where he was. And we were hearing on the radio how people were freezing in their cars in Montana and Idaho. And so when he finally called me from Portland, why, I was very much relieved. Well, then I said, don't you dare come back in that car. So he took the train back, and he got into Hoopston at the 23rd of December, just 2 days before Christmas. Yeah, so we were all together. And that was great for my parents. They were just so happy that it happened. And of course, the whole thing about food and everything, we weren't rationed anymore, but things were still very hard to get. And of course, appliances, that was terrible. Because you couldn't buy an appliance. They hadn't made any. You couldn't buy a new car. And so we bought a house that my grandparents had built in Hoopston, Illinois, and moved in there. Well, we didn't have a furnace. Neither one of us had ever lived in a house that didn't have a bathroom. And this did not have a bathroom. And it did not have a furnace, and it did. Of course, we had to use a cook stove in the kitchen, and we bought a warm morning heater for the dining room. And it was pretty rough for a while, but I got a washer because the man who ran the appliance store I had known him since I was a little kid, and he said, and I had two babies by then. You need the washer better, more than anybody I know. So I got the washer, and then we had to have an ice box rather than a refrigerator. And of course you had to have a pan underneath to catch the water as the ice melted. Invariably Jacket was never used to that, and he would never remember to empty it. So you got in the kitchen, be walking in ice cold water in the morning. But we lived through it, and he had a lot of help. My dad and a couple of one of our farmer friends came in with a scoop and helped him dig the basement. And he did most of the work himself. My brother helped him. We put a furnace in the basement, and he put in the bathroom. And by the time we got the house painted, he was working for an insurance company by then, and they transferred him to Champaign.
I mean, looking back at it all, was it worth it?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was. You know, we had some good times in that little house. My brother and his wife, my youngest brother and his wife lived there, and they had two little boys. And on Saturday night, they didn't have a car either, so they get in a taxi. We didn't have a car for years. They get in a taxi and come, and we'd play pinochle all evening. And sometimes they stayed all night because we had a lot more room. They built a lot of temporary housing, which is still there in Hoopston, for returning servicemen. And they were two-bedroom houses and they were rentals. And my brother and his wife lived in one of those. They went from that to taking care of the migrant workers. I don't know what they're using them for now, but I don't think they've ever torn them down. They called them tin houses. But there were a lot of temporary houses after the war.
It must have been a relief, though, after worrying about people being away.
Oh, it was. It was great to have people home. So we never, ever took that for granted again. When the Korean War came around, the Vietnam War, my older boys had to register for the draft. Well, my oldest son decided he was going to join the Navy, and he was up at Great Lakes, but they sent him home because he could not wear the uniform. He was extremely allergic to wool. And then none of the other ones were ever called. So,
what's the biggest lesson you think you all learned?
I think for me it was appreciating every day we had, and enjoying the small things, because we did without a lot, you know, and nothing was as important as the people that were close to you and your family. Yeah. My family's always been very, very important. Now I have 29 grandchildren and 27 great-grandchildren. And most of them live around here. I'm so lucky. Now, some of them, the children are moving away, but I have all of my children, well, I have 11, and four of them do not live here.
You had 11 children?
Mm-hmm. Seven boys and four girls.
Whoa.
They all come home.
That's wonderful.
They do. And there are times that they come there to see one another. If one is home, then they all have to come and see the rest of them.
We're just about out of time. Is there anything you want to add?
No.
No? Okay, well, she said no.
Right. I can't think of much of else, except I think my parents were very courageous. What else could they do?
Right. What do you want to?
Let me put it a little on a roll.
Okay, this is the second tape with Frances Snyder, and we were just about to talk about what you thought about your parents, how they lived through it.
Well, they were very courageous. They really were, because they had their three sons, and my brother, who was in Panama, was not very good about communications. We didn't hear very much from him at all, and there were times that we didn't know whether he was still there or not. And even the communications from overseas weren't all that good. You would write the emails and hope that they would get to them, and I gathered that there were a lot more going from here to there than came back. Although Jack wrote a lot to his parents, because his father kept every single one that Jack wrote from England, and had them filed in order of date.
Yes.
He was very German and very meticulous about it. And every time he wrote a letter, he would make a carbon copy and keep the letter, even if it was just a personal letter. I know.
Yes. At least he could do that because he wasn't on the front.
Right, right. And he was a civil defense, I don't know what you call him, but he ran the civil defense organization in their neighborhood. So he was in Cincinnati. They were, you know, they had blackouts, and they did a lot of collecting we did save everything. That was one of the things we learned, to recycle old tires and any kind of metal and fat. There was a jar on the stove that anything you cooked, you poured the fat into it and poured off the water and saved it for munitions. And, of course, anything metal and any appliance or anything like that, old tires, I did mention that. Now, I have an interesting story about a car. When I worked at Spiegel's, one of my friend's husband was drafted, and he was in the Navy, and she had a little apartment that she did not want to give up, and she asked me if I'd come and live with her. Well, I was living in a sleeping room, and it was kind of nice to be able to cook our food and everything, so I moved in with her for a while, and she had a car. So he had taught her to drive before he left for the Navy. And so she drove to work every morning, and we had a group of people we'd picked up, and everybody contributed their gas stamps so that we would be able to drive to work, because you had to have stamps in order to buy gasoline. And so this one day after work, while we were going out to get in the car, and I stopped to speak to somebody, and she came running back in. She said, "My car is gone." And so she called the police, and they came, and she answered their questions, but the car was stolen out of the parking lot where she had it at work. And, of course, then we had to take the streetcar home. And about a month later, the police called her. They had found her car, and it was put up on blocks, and the tires were gone. So she got the car back, but not the tires. They didn't really want the car. They all wanted the tires. And so it sat in a garage for the rest of the war until they began manufacturing tires again, because people who worked in defense industries were able to get tires and to get gasoline too, because they had to be at work. But we weren't in a defense industry, so we couldn't do it.
Just another change.
But it was interesting that they really didn't want to trash the car, and it made a difference because it was up on the blocks. Then at least they put it on blocks when they took the tires.
They were polite to you.
Yes, but the same way with the food now. It was hard sometimes. Even if you had ration stamps, you couldn't get the merchandise because they didn't have it. It wasn't shipped in, for instance, to Rankin, to the little butcher shop. Somebody would go in and ask, "Do you have any meat today?" And the butcher would tell him what he had, and then it'd be all over town in 10 minutes, and there'd be a big line to get the kind of meat they had. And my mother had chickens. She raised chickens, so she always had the eggs and the chickens, you know, which was a big advantage. And they had their garden, so we always had fresh vegetables and that sort of thing. But you also noticed it in restaurants that they didn't have the extensive menus. And it was good for people to have to do without a little bit, because we certainly didn't starve, not like some of the people in the European countries.
Right.
So that was just another part of the war that affected everybody.
Right. Anything else you want to add?
What?
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I can't think of anything. Okay. I think I've covered a lot.
Okay. It's a wrap then. Thank you. This has been fascinating.
What time is it? Oh my gosh, I've been talking a long time.
Well, you